Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
I'm Linda Pelaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and a director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Shuho Yagi, or some people know him as Bon Yagi, who is the owner of TIC Group, which operates 12 Japanese restaurants in New York, including the legendary Hasaki, Decibel, and Sakagura. I'm sure most of you have been to at least one of his restaurants and a good time. Hello and welcome to the show, Yagi-san.
Hi, how are you?
So, you're known as the creator of Little Tokyo or Japantown in East Village. For instance, in February, the online magazine Eater New York published an article, Visitor's Guide to the East Village's Little Tokyo, and you were named as the mayor of Little Tokyo in the article. So, how did it start? Why did you decide to come to New York in the first place?
Well, first of all, thank you very much. You honor me to say the mayor of the East Village. I'm not yet. Maybe when I die, maybe become mayor. I'm trying to still process making East Village as the town. Many people can enjoy the food, enjoy Japan without airfare. Mm. Anyway, you ask me how did I come to U.S.? Well, we were born in 1948 with many kids, baby boomer, so-called. Mm. And I was just a wild kid, and I figure when I saw the American TV program, American movies, I thought I want to get there and do something one of those days.
Right.
So I trying to get into college in Tokyo. And I had a hard time to get into college because my friend, who graduated 1 year before me, he was working in Tokyo part-time, doing some work for his school, help his school tuitions. Then I visited the night before for the examination of my college entrance examination. I had... you know, in Japan, they call you have to help the person, you know, if you're going to stay overnight. So in the morning, I get up. He was delivering milk early in the morning. So I was helping him to deliver milk. And I was late for the examination for 10 minutes. That's why I'm here in the United States right now. And I think that was a good choice.
Hey, you have to thank your friend.
Yeah.
Wow. So, but, you know, before you came, you were really interested in coming here. So how did you study English?
Oh, so when I, couldn't pass the test, so I figure I'm going to do, because I had only one application for the college, and then I decided to go to U.S. So there was no school like these days in Japan, like Ekimai, you know, there's an English language school in front of every Yamanote station. And I had to go to Sony just to build a very, the chic new style showroom in Ginza, Yonchome,
I believe. I think it's that the building is known for Sony building, like the center of Western culture at that time.
Yes.
Right.
So I used to carry the dictionary, Japanese-English or English-Japanese dictionary, and then I used to talk to tourists, especially, you know, young girls. And I said, can I help you? Or, you know, I try and approach. And once they say, oh, are you a student? Then I say, yes, I'm learning some English to prepare to go to U.S. And do you have a time? Can you go to Kisaten?
Kisaten is
coffee
a,
shop.
Yeah, right.
Then I learned English. That's how I learned English before I come to U.S. Yeah.
It's amazing. But you always wanted to, I mean, the U.S. was a kind of dream. Not in Japan, you wanted to achieve something in the United States. So where did that mindset come from?
Like I said, the Japan is so many kids. Everybody study hard. You know, it's hard. That time, everybody want to go college. Everybody want to, you know, the Japan was like growing rapidly so much, and I had to do something different than ordinary people.
Mm.
So I took the one-way ticket from Japan and went to Yokohama, I went to Hawaii, and then to San Francisco, took 12 days. Then after that, I took a Greyhound bus, crossed the San Francisco to East Coast, because I had a address from when I was in Japan. Before I leave Japan, I had a working in a U.S. Army camp and Camp Zama, and I met a couple of private soldiers, and they gave me address. So when I go to U.S., please visit. And when I came to U.S., that was totally different world, because still segregation, you know, there was the white and the blacks, they were living separated. And well, Philadelphia wasn't bad, not like the South, but I thought when I was a kid, I saw the my three sons or TV program, or, you know, the most American movie, we saw the fabulous, you know, rich family kind of
like a
lifestyle.
Right, like Lassie. Or
yes,
that
Lassie,
kind of.
Yes. And then I, when I reached in Philadelphia, I found out this was totally different, you know. And my life say, oh, but if I do work hard, I think I can do something in my life. You know, that was my first settled in Philadelphia,
right,
in the U.S.
So, but you had to support actually yourself, right? So I heard you did work. You worked as a gas station attendant, dishwasher, and even like a grape digger.
Yes.
A lot of different kinds.
I enjoyed, you know, I figure if I have to do anything I can grab on it, and I thought it was going to be not, you know, immediately it's going to be American dream, but all those experience, you know, from pumping gas to work in a cemetery, any job I found, I thought, you know, right now, this is my foundation, because that's like self-taught life experience that's going to future, you know, the use of my life. So I think, you know, probably you're going to ask me later, what's for the young people? I would say, you know, never afraid, especially when you're young. You know, you got to try. You know, there's a mountain, you got to go up.
Right.
And then after leech, you know, you have to find out how you're going to come down. Then you're going to find another mountain. You know, it's a life. It's just up and down, you know, with a lot of load on your shoulder.
It's amazing because right now I think Japanese young people are not willing to go abroad because they're trying to be safe, especially after the recession started in 1991. So I think your mindset is pretty inspiring for them.
Yeah, that's why I came today. If I can mention that a little bit to you, you know, there's so many, you know, things without the, not only internet, you can find it, you know. You've got to go out there, get the information from internet, then you start doing yourself, you know, get up and, you know, you have to do it.
Right. And so you eventually moved to East Village after traveling around. And in 1976, you started a wholesale grocery, green grocery business. So why a green grocery business?
I was, you know, settling in East Village before I traveled around the world. Like I said, any money I saved it, I spent it for traveling because I wanted to see, you know, around the world how the people live, how they eat. So I traveled hitchhiking Europe, and I drove a car from Germany with three other friends into India, then explored the Asia. I went back to Japan and that time many young people, we call hippies, but they're traveling, you know, cross culture. American went to Japan and the European went to, you know, America. You know, everybody was traveling.
Mm.
And then I saved some money in Japan and came to U.S. and I did a little business in the Martha's Vineyard in Oak Bluff. And from there, one summer I spent it, but it's a seasonal business, so I figure, you know, I have to hit to the capital of the world, which is New York. Mm. And I saved some money and I bought the van, and just myself with my best friend, Mr. Wakayama, was my buddy since we were high school. So he came to U.S. after a year later when I left Japan, which is he's the one I was helping.
The milk
delivery. And then I was late. But again, we're still friends. We always, you know, whatever chance we have to meet. And he has a business in New York and also in Japan. So we are like more than brothers, mm-hmm. you know. And again, came to New York with that van. So I figure, what kind of business, you know, I can do? I was very fascinated all the time with the, food business, because when I came to the U.S., I did a lot of, you know, job, but always make my stomach full with the restaurant business.
Mm.
So I figure if I open the business, many, you know, young people, they come, I can feed them, so I can return them, and, you know, maybe they can do the first step and they can do whatever business they want to do, but working restaurant, you get two meals a day. You know, that's why, you know, I wanted to do a restaurant. Then I came to New York, but you can't start business right away. I mean, I didn't have any, you know, starting up money. So I figure I should check the each, like, kitchens, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So how to go into the restaurant's kitchen?
Mm-hmm.
I can't just knock on the door unless I apply it. So I wanted to see American, French, or Japanese, you know, any type of restaurant. I figure if I do become a wholesale vegetable vendor, I thought, you know, I can visit it. That's why, you know, I brought the van from Massachusetts, and then I start wholesale vegetables without knowing any technique or any sales mind about the wholesale vegetable,
right.
Yeah.
Ah, it's like going to school, and it's a very strategic move. Right. And you also managed a diner called 103 Second as well. And why did you open it, and what kind of diner was it?
Okay, that's connected with the wholesale vegetable business, because when you do the vegetable business, you got to go to midnight to Bronx and fruits and vegetable market. You come back like at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you sort it out, and you have a few trucks, and you unload it and put it into another smaller truck, delivery. So I needed a station. So in the East Village on 2nd Avenue 6, there used to be a supermarket, Lyons Supermarket, and right next to was the Fillmore East. Some of the people listener probably knows the, you know, Fillmore West, Fillmore East. Fillmore East was, you know, very well known live concert hall,
mm.
and the restaurant 103 Second was right next to it. And later on, that Fillmore East became the disco called the Saint.
Mm.
But anyway, I find out that there was an open space, used to be supermarket. They had a basement, they had a refrigerator, freezer, everything. So I figure if I take that space to do the wholesale vegetable, the first floor was big space. So I figure, you know, I get the fresh fruits, a vegetable. So why don't I use that vegetable? You know, after sorted out, some of them, you know, left. So before the next day, I want to use up. So I opened up a 103 second. And I didn't tell anybody, you know, Japanese running the 103 second, because most employees was Americans, and we just go midnight to wholesale market, you come back, and the restaurant was 24 hour, 8 o'clock to 4 o'clock, 4 o'clock to midnight, you know, never stop around the clock. And we're young, energy, so we figure we go to market, and, you know, we hire a chef.
Right. And, yeah, and I heard it became the commissary for artists and performers, including Keith Haring, Andy Warhol, and John Belushi, and Madonna, those people.
So. Yes, I was very fortunate to meet these people before they become famous. And some of the other, you know, customer, you know, they become restaurateur, and you know, they do a lot of different business, but most, a lot of people was very unique and interesting people we serve.
Right. And eventually in 1984, you opened your first Japanese restaurant, which is a sushi place called Tasaki in East Village. That is still so popular that I always have to wait to get in. But did you plan to build the Japantown already back then at the point?
Well, again, when I first opened a store in East Village, vegetable wholesale, actually retail and the wholesale place, I saw the church called the St. Mark's Church, and I was wandering around in a courtyard, and I saw the Commodore Perry, which is, he's the commander, opened up in Japan, you know, around in 1800. So the Japan was finishing their Sakoku.
The closed country for 200
years. Yeah,
closed
country, yeah, that's opened up. So Commodore Perry, I said, why he's there? And then I said, East Village, and I'm from East Japan. So I said, this must be something I have to do, you know, settle here and then develop some, you know, the community. Mm-hmm. And again, to develop community, you have to be melted into the, you know, the neighborhood, and which is I was doing already, selling the vegetable. So you know, a lot of people know me, and then when I opened up Hasaki, and you know, people, they accepted me, you know, as a Japanese restaurant.
But how popular was Japanese food back then? It's not as much as now, for sure.
The sushi was just, you know, coming up, and I don't know, it's a funny story. I mean, you heard about, like, a tolo, lala, when you go to market, American fish stores, they used to throw away. They didn't know what tolo was. Like, well, maybe 25 years ago, I guess, still, when the Union Square Market, they opened up, and there's a fish guy come, and my wife used to go there and buy the tolo, you know, belly of the tuna. It was so cheap. Then they discovered that's very pricey stuff after many sushi places opened up, and then they start charging triple. So, you know, when I opened up a sushi place, there was only, you know, maybe 10 sushi specializing, I mean, you know, store was there, and then I inspired by the restaurant called Hatsana in the Midtown. That was the traditional sushi place, you know, come from Japan. And I tried to make the longest counter in the East Village. But we had some couple of incidents. People throw some letters saying, we don't need the fancy Japanese restaurants in the East Village. because, you know, people thought I'm going to be charging a lot of money.
Mm.
But my concept was, you know, the ambience and the food is uptown, but the downtown price.
Mm.
And I think still Hasaki is very reasonable price, and I'm serving to the community, you know. So I guess those people first they didn't know, so that's why they throw some, left some letter saying we don't need the, you know, midtown expensive restaurant. But
I'd imagine that time East Village was still artistic and more culturally kind of active than now. So this uptown is no. Right. Okay. So what was the biggest challenge in running a sushi restaurant back then?
To get the, you know, fresh ingredients, I mean, nowadays you have, you know, 3, 4, 5 different supplier. Those days, you know, only few. And especially if you don't, you know, can froze the fish. I mean, nowadays we're talking about the in New York, you know, you got to frozen the fish. Certain fishes can, you know, frozen. Once you froze, you cannot use it.
Mm.
So that means, you know, you have to be getting every day fresh fish. That was very hardest that time, you know.
Okay. And what kind of people came to Hasaki?
Well, we had the you know, East Village that. The people came from the on the Lafayette. Do you know that the theater in Lafayette?
Oh, the public theater.
Yeah, right. Public theater. The director, he used to come.
Ah,
yeah.
Wow. Right. Okay, so this started to be already a cultural center in a way, and even now I know quite a few Western really successful chefs go to Hasaki. For the quality and the price.
Thank you very much.
Right. All right. So now let's take a quick break here. Mm-hmm. And when we come back, we'll talk about Mr. Yagi's, how he manages 12 popular restaurants. So please stay with us.
Paying attention? Are you there? Hello, 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 hello. I'm talking to you. Hi. Hey, this is Jack Inslee. I'm the executive producer here at Heritage Radio Network. I've been here at the station since 2009, and I cannot believe just how much this network has grown over that time. We've been able to grow because of donations from people like you. So if you're enjoying this, if you laughed, if you learned something, contribute anything. $1, $2, $10, $100, $1,000, anything counts. And trust me, we'll appreciate seeing your name come through on the donations. So consider visiting heritageradionetwork.org, click on that little beating heart, the donate button, and show us you care. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Shuho Yagi, who is the owner of TIC Group, which operates 12 Japanese restaurants in New York, including legendary Hasaki, Decibel, and Sakagura. And he's known as the founder of the Japantown in East Village. So when you opened your first restaurant in Hasaki in 1980s, people didn't know much about Japanese food. So you started a Japanese festival called Nihon Matsuri in East Village to educate the public. So what kind of festival was it?
Yes, again, when I saw the tombstone of Commodore Perry in the St. Mark's Church, I felt, you know, this is the another Japan, which is in New York. It's, we don't have any Japanese restaurants all over, but there was not concentrated in one spot like Los Angeles or San Francisco. And I always respect, you know, the people who came first in, you know, United States, and especially to New York, and opened up a Japanese restaurant. They had a more courage and adventurous spirit than us. So I wanted to continue those spirit into East Village. So since, again, Perry Commodore helped Japan open the culture and everything, so I figure maybe open up some Japanese culture in East Village, which is, you know, not only my restaurant. There's Sam Marks is Yakitori Taisho. They have the Sunrise Market. You know, so many other, like nowadays, Ippudo here, and many restaurants can survive in the community. So, like you said, how can I educate the customer? I figure if I open up a different type of Japanese food, they will come, and plus many other people with the idea open up Japanese essence food in East Village. I figure if I do the festival called Akimatsuri, especially in Japan, the matsuri is like once a year, wherever your, you know, hometown is, you usually go back. We call it the deceased people come back, the Ohigan, which is right now in Japan is Ohigan, and they have it twice a year. Those times they do a festival. So I figured in East Village, once we start a festival, which is many Japanese young people working in Manhattan or, you know, all over the New York area, those people, unfortunately, that time, you know, 80s, they couldn't go back to Japan. So I figure if I do the festival, those people can come once here in East Village and they can enjoy, especially if they're married, they have a little children. So we have a children's mikoshi, which is a portable shrine you carry, and then adult shrine. Then we had all the vendors from, you know, local people, and, you know, we have the cultural kendo, we had the mochitsuki, we had the dance, you know, all kind of a festivity event was held in Matsuri.
So it's also it's for the New Yorkers education, but also it's more for the Japanese community, it sounds like.
Yes, so, you know, again, the spirit is the Ohigan, which is, you know, the family, deceased people come back spiritual-wise, and then you have the festival, you know, comfort food, you know, street food, which is like in Brooklyn they do now, you know, Smorgasburg, those kind of feeding. It's street food and then cultural event. And we did that for, you know, several years, and a lot of people enjoy it. I guess now they moved to Central Park.
Okay. Yeah. Right. So that's the Japan Day at Central Park.
Right.
And I think the last May they gathered 50,000 people. So it grew tremendously.
Right.
And the festivals, typically, I think not just in Japan, like you said, it creates all those memories, the food memories. So that is great.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And, well, by the way, according to the 2010 data from the Japanese government, there are approximately 1,500 Japanese restaurants in New York. And this is almost five times more than the last research in 1992. So I'm sure there are more, even more now. And I think you contributed to these numbers by raising interest in Japanese food for the last 30 years now.
Thank you. And the Japanese food is, as you know, the very you know, oriented and the focus on the freshness, and then you know, sometimes no cooking. So in other words, you can grill, you can steam, you know, you can eat raw, you know, all different type of cooking. Japanese food is the known for, and the flavor is from, you know, the sweet to sour to fermentations. So I think many, you know, not only Japanese food, you know, even Italian or French or any food, they can use the Japanese method for the cooking without breaking their tradition, you know. You know, to bring up flavor, umami, I think.
So it's a very versatile food to be shared with in different cultures. And I heard you are active in donating to local organizations such as churches and police stations. And also, I heard you gave up drinking sake that you loved after September 11 until the days reached the number of the victims. So it sounds like you have a very strong sense of community. And where does it come from?
My father, actually my mother's side, I raised very strongly. I don't know, you know Akashige, which is like a doctor who is helping the, you know, suffering people, the poor or rich.
It's a Kurosawa and Redbeard, I think it's available. I watched it here.
Right. And my mother's family was 15 generations, and back maybe 10 generations back was a samurai time, and they were helping the older villager. So I guess my family tradition is say, you don't have to be rich, don't have to, you know, doesn't matter who you are or, you know, your rank, you just need to help people. So when I came here, you know, I can make beautiful restaurant, I can make, you know, my chef can make a beautiful food, and, you know, I get good server, you're missing the customer. So to bring customer, you know, you have to, you know, work with the community, because, you know, it doesn't matter you're in New York, you're in San Francisco, you know, you built, if you, three element you have it, but you need a customer, right? If you in Alaska, in nowhere, you built a restaurant, you know, you cannot survive. You need a customer, which is, customer means they're community there, so I have to return to community. So, you know, we help the local police. They do who policemen who was fighting crime, you know, against the in a local, especially 9th precinct, and then they do Christmas time. They give the kids to a Christmas gift for needy kids. They lined up, like, you know, almost like all day to get the stuff. So not only I'm helping, you know, many Ukrainian restaurant, Japanese restaurant, all those people, we chipped in and we get the gift, and they have a tent in front of the precinct, and also the musicians and the entertainment while they are lined up, you know, they don't get the board on the line. So those kind of stuff, it's again, it's a community together. So I figure, you know, I can give back to community little my, you know, profit or my effort, you know. It's not the amount or, you know, anything. You know, just those, I think, to survive in the East Village as a Japanese community, I think it's very important to work with that. And also you asked me about September 11, I gave up my, I love sake because, you know, I have a Desville Sakagura. And when September 11, 2001, I was nearby that day in 8:45. And then prior to that, they had a bomb was exploded in the basement. That was the second time. And September 11, I saw the people, you know, jumping from the building, and we had a run from the, because we are not in the building, we're the, near the immigration, mm-hmm. and we ran through the Chinatown back to my office, which is East Village, and my daughter's friend's mother passed away mm-hmm. in that incident, and I figure I got saved by twice, because mm-hmm. first time I was there also right. when the explosion happened. Mm-hmm. The second time was nearby, so I said to myself again, what I can give to those people who mm-hmm. die, over almost 3,000 people, mm-hmm. I said I have to give up my drink, you know, play every day for right. that time. Mm-hmm. And after the, you know, the 10 years, my son became 21. I had to celebrate his 21, okay. so that was a good timing to, right. you know, have a little toast of sake.
Right. Okay. So so your second restaurant was the Shabu Shabu place called the Shabutatsu, and the third one was the sake bar called Isabel, which opened in 1993, and the fourth one was Sobaya, a handmade soba noodle shop. And then in 2000, before ramen became a keyword for gourmet, you opened a Rai Rai Ken. And now you have a Japanese Swiss cafe, a curry shop, a takoyaki shop, etc. And all of your places have been very popular. So what's the key to success?
I always look, you know, again, you can't forget the where you come from, you know. It's like we say the eels, unagis, always after they're born in somewhere in the Pacific, especially near, you know, I'm talking about the Japan, you know, the Philippine area, and then always a small fish come back to where they were born, you know, they return. And again, you know, I'm not going back to Japan. You know, I became American almost 25 years ago. This is my home, and but always I look to the Japan. And since, you know, I trying to promote the Japan in East Village, I figure I can introduce specialty store, you know, specialty comfort food, mm. and then any Japanese young people who wants to open up in the U.S., mm. they can see from mm. my restaurant and see, oh, this is the trend. But I will always, when I opened up a curry shop, I went to Japan and I went to maybe one day, like a 10, and I eat 10 curry shop, same thing ramen, I checked. So when I opened up a Lailaken, I figure, what ramen can you eat every day, ramen? You know, I show you, and mm. that's the original. Mm. And after the war, you know, ramen was most comfortable food and, you know, most popular. So I figure in the U.S., you know, to introduce ramen. Now ramen is, you know, all kind of ramen, but, you know, first when the American mm. tasted the ramen, I just wanted to be comfortable. So that's why they show you, you know.
Mm. Yeah. Right. I mean, including Asaki, you know, sushi is very traditional. And I think your place always the traditional. So people go back and then you can learn what the traditional Japanese food is.
Yes. Again, traditional is the, you know, you always said that before. And then I think the success, well, again, you know, from there, many people, they get ramen, you know, tradition, but some food you can survive with, you know, trying to make different food. But I think myself, my concept is always original. You know, go back to original. Mm. That's my key.
Right. Okay. And so that's why maybe you don't open a branch of a popular restaurant, but you always open the new genre.
Right. Thank you.
Right. And so one of them, I think, is a very unique restaurant. I'd like our listeners to know what kind of restaurants you have. So I think one of the most unique concepts among your restaurants is the High Collar, which opened in 2013. Maybe you can tell us what kind of place that is?
Yes. A Kissa Ten concept. In the United States, it's the right now third generation coffee, I believe.
Right, you know? The third wave.
Third wave. Right. And those people, they study about the Kissa Ten in Japan, mm. And I grew up in Japan, you know, when I was high school, we used to go to kissaten all the time and enjoyed it. So,
right, so kissaten is basically kind of, for Japanese people, that was kind of beginning of Western, you know, sense. If you go to this cafe, it's not like a Japanese tea shop, but Western experience and high quality tea and coffee.
And sandwiches and some spaghetti, you know. You can taste like a toast, you know, in the morning service with the hard boiled egg. So kissaten is the you know, morning to like a late night gathering place. Especially Japan at that time was very housing was very, you know, living in small yojohan, which is you know, only four tatami space.
Right.
They didn't have a living room. Nowadays it's different.
Right.
So they're trying to you know, closing Lala Kisaten, but since the third wave came, now Japan, they realize that, you know, we American, we teach Japanese, the coffee culture is very important, and then Japan has a quality coffee shop.
Right, so that's exactly why Blue Bottle Coffee kind of learned from Japanese way to make coffee with siphons, which you use to make coffee at high color.
We only, you know, make with a siphon and the drip, and we don't have an espresso or, you know, any other machine, just a AeroPress we have. Anything is a hand, we use it, but we don't use a machine in high color.
Right, and I when I was there, I ordered a pot of tea, and then the sunglass came with it. It was very nostalgic and classic, yeah. Okay, and you serve the Japanese, you know, sandwiches and, you know, the om rice, which is yoshoku. And when, you know, kissaten became popular in early 20th century, that yoshoku became a popular food. So you can experience it, Haikawa.
It's a Taisho period, you know, that's the turn of, after Edo, it became Meiji, but then Meiji was just transitional from samurai to get used to with a little Western culture. But then once Western culture settled, the Taisho period, they bring in more like details, you know, like a bar, cafe bar, kissaten, and like drinking style wines, and, you know, more like Western culture was start growing in Taisho period, you know.
Right. Okay, so this is the last question for you. So how do you predict the future of Japanese cuisine in New York, in America?
I think one area, it's not in the restaurant business in New York by Japanese influence, is in Japan, many young people right now less, but they go to Italy, they go to France, they come to U.S. They study abroad for cooking. And they go back to Japan, and then, again, they use umami, you know, the flavors, and how to take a dashi in Japanese style. Those Western food, French or Italians or any other restaurant cuisine, maybe they can bring to U.S., I think, some, you know, adventurous, to, you know, not the fusion. I'm talking about the, you know, traditional Italian and traditional French, you know, trend in that each country, you know, and they open up in Japan and they modify the Japanese taste.
Right.
So those maybe start coming into U.S. and challenging with the, you know, American chef or French chef who owns in New York,
right,
you know, famous Italian or French, maybe some Japanese adventurous chef.
Right.
He's going to come and challenge in the U.S. market.
Right.
I think that's going to be the direction.
Right. So inspiring each other.
Kind of.
Right. All right. So thank you for joining us today, Yagi-san.
You are welcome.
So listeners, if you'd like to know more about Yagi-san's restaurants, please visit TIC-Japan.com. heritageradionetwork@nyc.com. And if you have any questions or comments, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. By the way, we just launched a new beautiful new website, so please visit our page, Japan Eats. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org. Today's engineer was Liz Smith, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.